Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. If you happened to be in Essex last Tuesday night, you might have noticed a parade of bright, flashing vehicles cruising through town. Fire trucks with lights on, police cars, and of course the famous SD Ireland dump truck fully lit. Well, that was the second parade of the year organized by our next guest, a guy who seems to spend all his free time trying to make other people smile. Troy Austin was one of the many people whose job was put on hold when the pandemic hit. But unlike the rest of us, he decided to use that spare time to make a difficult time a little bit better for everyone that he could. And he joins us now to talk about how he's gone about doing that. Troy Austin, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask Troy a question or if you attended one of the events that he's organized, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Troy, you've really been stepping it up to do special things for people in your community during this pandemic. Why do you feel that you need to do this for people?
I want to see smiles on people's faces, and I don't want to see people down during the holiday season, so it's just nice to get out and do fun events, safe fun events during COVID. And I thought of doing the parade, and it's the best way to spread the spirit of the holiday season.
Why are those smiles so important to you, Troy?
To know that people are enjoying the holiday season and to know that people have something to look forward to. I know that a bunch of kids, they love seeing lights, and there's not really much to do, so doing a parade gives them joy from this and happiness for the holiday season.
That's beautiful. Now, earlier in the year, when COVID kind of first started, you utilized your photography skills. First of all, where did you learn photography?
I took a class at Essex High School, and the teacher, she was really great. She showed us what to do with camera, and she was just a really great teacher, and I took that skills and decided to make my own photography volunteer business. So I can go around to different people's houses and take pictures for them for free and send them the photos after. And there's no charge at all. I just do it so the family can have something to look forward to.
And how did people react when they got the photos?
All the people, they loved the photos. There was one family in Hinesburg that asked if I could come back and take more photos.
Wow.
And I decided to do that, and they want me back each year to take photos for them.
Oh, that's beautiful. Now, you mentioned the teacher at Essex High School who taught you photography. Do you remember her name and want to give a shout out to that person?
Yeah, her name is Wendy James. And she was a great teacher. She doesn't work at the high school anymore, but she used to work at the high school 2 years ago, I believe.
What do you think an act of kindness like this, like the photography, means to a community like Essex?
It means a lot because there's wasn't that much to do this summer, so people are looking for stuff to do with family, and they found out about what I was doing, so they contacted me and asked if I could meet them somewhere or come over to their house to take a picture while being social distance. People were looking forward to doing something fun.
Do you know how many families you wound up photographing?
I believe so far I've done 15 families.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, you're a security guard. Did the pandemic affect your job status?
It did at the beginning, but right now I do about 40 hours of work.
Oh.
But I work at Essex High School, and I work for Green Mountain Concert Services.
Mm-hmm. So not a whole lot of concert services, but still the high school you have work to do, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And you've maintained this very positive outlook during the pandemic. How do you do that, Troy?
I just look for creative ways to do events. Like, I did a toy drive on December 12th, and it was a drive-through event. And we had a bunch of lighted-up trucks that were social distanced. And people drove through to see the trucks, and they had a bag of treats. Then in the middle of the parking lot, there's a Santa Claus. And then when they start to leave the parking lot, that's where the toy drop-off was. And people dropped off toys, and we got 1,000 toys donated for that event. And all of them went to families in Chittenden County and all over Vermont.
Wow. 1,000 toys you collected. Was that on one night, or was that going on for a period of time?
That was only one night event. And we had 372 cars between 4 and 6 p.m.
So describe that parade that you put together last week that started this all and got all those toys donated.
Yeah, so the parade had a Army National Guard vehicle. Then TDI towing came out. SDR Ellen came out, and a bunch of Jeeps and South Hero Fire Department came out. And then Essex Fire Department and Essex Police were the escorts. And we just drove around Chittenden County, just brightening people's spirits up for the holiday season. And I got a bunch of people were like, are you going to be doing the parade again? But unfortunately, we're not for right now, but I'm trying to think of something creative to do for New Year's Eve.
Oh, my gosh. You're still not resting. New Year's Eve is only a few days away. That's Thursday, so... But, Troy, when I think about, like, this parade, and like you said, you had South Hero, you had National Guard, you had Essex, SD Ireland, all these different organizations, I think of the logistics, the organization that it took. Tell people, you know, what you had to do to get all that coordinated and then have a parade route. What was that like?
I had to contact everyone on my own, and hopefully I remember, like, who I called, and sometimes I have to, like, write down the list of who I called. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, when I did the toy drive, I lost that list of who I called. So I'm like, did I call you guys? But it's definitely hard to plan an event on my own, so I'm definitely looking for extra help to, like, help call people to see if they can come out.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine for one person that is an awful lot of work, and the organization it takes to coordinate such a parade with all those disparate parts, and had to be a new learning experience for you, obviously. But through all that, you know, why was it worthwhile to go through all that kind of aggravation? I'm not sure I would have done it just to put on a parade for other people.
It's rewarding when you're in the parade, because you get to drive down the street and you get to see people smiling, kids jumping up in the air, looking at all the lighted up trucks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely uplifting to see all the happiness when we're driving down the street. I play Christmas music with a big speaker that I got from the music store in Williston, so I I just loved seeing all the smiles on people's faces when we drive by, and just uplifting to see people be happy during the holiday season.
Now, I think you might have just said something. So you not only coordinated this parade, you got to ride in it. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I was the third vehicle in the parade.
What were you riding in or on?
I was riding in my Nissan Rogue. Uh-huh. I decked it all out in Christmas lights, and Essex Equipment Rental, they donated a generator to me, and I'm going to be returning it after the New Year's. So they've been really gracious for lending a generator so I can use.
Wow.
So we tied that down to the roof next to a big speaker, and then we have Christmas lights all around the car with a battery pack, and I plug in two lights there. So all around the car, there's cords plugged into different areas.
Is it still lit? Is it still wired?
It's still lit.
Oh, I love it.
It's going to be lit until January 1st, and okay. We're taking all the lights down.
All right. Boy, that sounds like fun, but a lot of work. Troy, the parade you just did, that was the second one I think you've organized this year. So tell us about the other one that you organized to show your appreciation for local law enforcement.
Yeah, so that was back in August, I believe. And we had about 100 participants with blue flags for the police officers. And we drove around to different police departments. We actually started at ADL in Essex, and then we went past Essex Police Station, Williston, South Burlington, Colchester, Winooski, and Burlington Police Stations. And we just drove by honking our horns, just saying thank you to all the police officers that are serving our community right now during this hard time.
Yep.
And it's definitely nice to give back to the police officers that serve and protect us.
Why was that something you wanted to do, Troy?
Just all the stuff going on the news. And I knew that there were different issues going on. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to just say that I still support them during this hard time right now.
Yep. They always do very difficult work to protect us. And so how did you get the word out and get 100 people to take part in that parade?
Facebook. I organized it on Facebook and just sharing it every day until the parade. And the word got out between different people. So I'm definitely the person that likes to organize and likes to broadcast through Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I always get a bunch of people to come out.
You must have quite a list of followers right now. Now, some people listening, right? Some people listening might have heard your name for the first time earlier this month when Governor Phil Scott called you an example of how Vermont lights the way. Did you have any idea that he was going to mention you in that news conference?
I did not. I was actually working security at the high school that day that he gave me a shout-out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working the front entrance at Essex High School. And when I was working, there was a bunch of people texting me, and one of my friends wrote on Facebook, Troy just got a shout-out on the governor's press conference today. So I'm like, wait, what? So I had turned on my phone and go on Facebook and look for the video, and I rewatched it from the beginning. So it was definitely uplifting to see that he gave me support as well.
Yeah, how did it feel to be recognized by the governor of Vermont for these programs, these events that you've been coordinating in your community?
It definitely feels uplifting that I know that the governor supports it. I know Jack Thurston from NBC5. Mm-hmm. He did a news story about my vehicle. And the next day, I believe, Phil Scott posted it on his Facebook about Troy Austin Lights Away. Mm. And then I did the toy drive, and people put my name in, apparently, for the press conference thing. Mm. And then Phil Scott mentioned me, and it was definitely encouraging to know that I have support from even the governor.
Yeah. You've been coordinating these parades. You drove in the last one, or both of them, I guess. Is there, you know, do parades speak to you? Do you go to parades? Have you been to, like, the Macy's Parade in New York? Or what is it about parades that just really jazz you, Troy?
I actually been to the Macy's Parade one time, but wow. I was maybe 6 or 7 years old at the time. But I just like doing parades to have people watch in the community, and it's just nice to get out and do something fun during the holiday season or during the summer to just give back to the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I ever hear that we're going to have big floating cartoon balloons down Burlington or Montpelier streets, it's a parade of that sort, I'm going to know. I know who coordinated all this. Had to be Troy Austin. Now, you've been doing a lot during the pandemic, but your community giving started back in high school. Am I right about that?
Yes, that's correct.
So tell us about how you started the toy drive that you put on back then.
So the first year that I hosted the toy drive, I was a junior, I believe, in high school. And we only had one truck outside of our house. And then the second year, we had two trucks and a DJ. And then the third year, it just gotten too big that we had to move it to Maple Street Park.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was a big success because we got four trucks, so we could fit more trucks in the parking lot.
Wow.
And then the fourth year, we got another truck that joined us. So I think that we got, like, eight trucks the fourth year. Then this year was the biggest year with the drive-thru event.
Mm-hmm.
To make it safe for the public to come out.
Wow.
So each year it's been getting more trucks coming out.
Yep.
And more people hear about it with the all the communications on Facebook and advertisements through, like, Local 2244 News and WCAX.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all these events seem to kind of start small and then have a point where they just really start to go, you know, really jump off.
Yeah.
Right? And so, but why did you start the toy drive in the first place back in high school?
I saw the NBC5 Toys for Kids ad, so I wanted to start raising toys and donating to the Toys for Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, each year, I've been donating all the toys again.
Right.
And it's been growing ever since. I know last year I got 300 toys, and then this year 1,000 toys. So it was a big bump in the how many toys we raised.
Wow.
This year.
1,000 toys. And where do you say they go to after you collect those?
They go to Toys for Kids with the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand.
And
go ahead.
They distribute them throughout Chittenden County and, I believe, Plattsburgh, New York as well.
Mm. Now, I understand that some people gave money for the cause as well. So where does that go?
So that goes to Toys for Kids as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then half of the money goes toward helping, like, with the event, because we still have to buy a bunch of hot chocolate, and we have to buy a bunch of stuff for the event to run smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Do you get people to volunteer? How do you put this all on, Troy?
Yes. So people from different workplaces, like my friend Chris Jones and Karen, and then Jim Whitehead, they all work with me, and then Jacob Porter, and then a bunch of other backstage crew, they help me set up. And then I have a bunch of security friends that helps me out during the event. So a bunch of people are on board to help me out. I had about 25 volunteers this year.
Wow.
And then last year I had about like 15 volunteers. So each year it's been growing ever since. Mm. So it's definitely uplifting that people support what I do, and they like to volunteer and help out.
Well, you mentioned that you might have something for New Year's Eve. So is there anything else you're thinking about that you're working on to make people in your community smile?
Yeah. Right now, I'm just working on plans for next year's toy drive.
Mm-hmm.
I always, the day after I do the toy drive, I start planning for next year. Like, what can I do better? What wasn't really working out during the event? So I definitely plan on making the event for next year as of right now.
You definitely have the ethic of a true events coordinator. As soon as one is done, they immediately look to the very next one. So you're definitely got it down pat now, Troy. Troy Austin, I want to thank you for making life better for all of us struggling through this pandemic and for being on with me this morning.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. We're going to pop out for the CBS News update. When we come back, we're going to have the Secretary of Agriculture, Food and Markets, Anson Tebbets, with us here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. From Vermont's Farm to Plate program to water quality improvements to promoting the natural sweetness of maple candy, Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, Foods, and Markets has a lot on its plate. And that's in a normal year. This year, the agency also has the responsibility to help Vermont's farmers and other food producers keep operating safely through the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining us this morning to talk about the agency's work is former WDEV News Director, current Secretary of Agriculture, Anson Tebbets. I want to thank you, Anson, so much for stepping in at the last minute this morning to be on with me.
Great to be here. Thank you very much, Rick.
And Anson, we'll take some calls from listeners. Our number is 244-1777, 877-291-8255. If you've got a question for Anson Tebbets, you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. It has been a crazy year for everyone, but can you tell us, Anson, in a general sense, how the pandemic has affected Vermont's farms?
Well, they've been right in the thick of it, of course, and they have remained open. We are grateful for all of our farmers, producers, the value-added food businesses, our restaurants, our clerks, and everyone that's been really just working overtime, you know, to feed Vermonters, but also keeping us safe. For the most part, we have been very fortunate that everything has stayed open in the agriculture field, and people are, you know, going about it. You know, they've taken the extra precautions. There's been some disruptions, of course. We know that that's happened in just about every field in Vermont and across the country. But for the most part, I would have to say agriculture has stepped it up and continues to you know, do the work that needs to be done to feed the Vermonters, but without disruption and without sacrifice. And some losses, of course, have happened during the pandemic as well.
I know we had the one outbreak at the orchard, but other than that, have our farms remained relatively COVID-free?
That's the case. That was one that luckily, once it was discovered, the agency worked very closely with the Vermont Health Department and got that contained. And, you know, everyone at the end of that remained healthy, and we learned from that as well. So it was all in all, that one was, you know, we dodged a bullet on that one, but for the most part, everything has remained stable in the ag industry as far as health and safety.
One of the challenges inherent to farming is that crops and livestock don't just stop producing if no one shows up to take care of them. Farmers can't exactly work remotely. So what was being done across the state this year to make sure farm workers could stay safe, even though many still had to go into work?
Yeah, you know, just like any other thing, you know, the advice that the health department has been giving us, you know, wear that mask, wash your hands a lot, don't go to work if you're sick, remain distance, you know, 6 feet away from everyone. The one advantage, you know, particularly during the summertime, is a lot of the work being done, you know, outside, so that, you know, they're not inside. But it's just those practices that to remain safe. And for the most part, that's happened. People just stepping up and taking care of those practices.
We did have a pretty dry season throughout the summer. And how much of that did affect our crops in Vermont?
Yeah, it was depending where you were. I mean, Addison County, some parts of Addison County, you know, some people would get rain one day, other areas would not get rain. There was, you know, drought conditions. Mm-hmm. A lot of the corn crop did suffer. You know, a lot of the vegetables, there was a lot of irrigation going on to keep it going, but it was not the easiest of summers working in those dry drought pockets of Vermont.
From an economic perspective, there's been a lot of federal aid money coming into the state. Also, a lot less economic activity of other kinds this year. Did Vermont's farms suffer because of that?
They certainly did, and we were fortunate enough. The governor and the Agency of Agriculture, one of the first programs that through the CARES dollars that came up from Congress in the first wave, we dedicated that to agriculture. We have just completed the grants that went out to those businesses in Vermont, and the numbers are not complete yet, but we figure of like close to 1,000 businesses related to agriculture did receive CARES Act dollars, totaling about $25 million. Now, that's just the state program. There were also federal programs available that were managed through USDA. So with those two programs, we hope it stabilized the situation. You know, there were incredible losses for some of our farmers because of the pandemic. They lost their markets because things closed up across the United States and New England and everywhere that they were, you know, shipping those wonderful Vermont products to. But we hope that that was enough to stabilize things and so they can have a better day coming in 2021 once you know, America opens up again and we can start getting into restaurants and institutions and schools again.
Did you hear of anyone that had to close down permanently because of this, the pandemic?
Yes, we did. We did lose without a doubt. I think it tipped some of our dairy farmers over the edge. We did lose three dairy processors over the last year. We did lose about 50 farmers, dairy producers. These are cow dairies in the last year. It's difficult to say if it was, you know, totally related to COVID, but I think COVID, particularly in the early days of it, the price of milk paid to farmers dropped dramatically. early on in the pandemic. We were talking about, you know, milk that got down to $14 per hundredweight, and you need $20 per hundredweight for the most part to, you know, cost of production. So we saw some of those that they were forced just because there was no place for that product to go. So I think we did lose, and, you know, that's the part of this story that's going to be played out over the next couple of years. You are going to see businesses that you thought never would suffer under, you know, would not go out of business, are going to go out of business because of just the economy. It just was so rugged. So we're doing the best we can to support them and get them through this period, and hopefully they can thrive at the end of the day once we get past this pandemic. The good sign is the vaccine is here. Mm-hmm. The more people we can get vaccinated, more things can open up, but we got some heavy lifting to go over the next few months.
Another good sign is even though those markets start to close down for our farmers, it did seem that Vermonters, because of what was happening around the country and around the world, turned to their Vermont farmers for, you know, more meats and for, you know, to buy directly from the farm. Did you see that? And how do we make, you know, that, how do we kind of foster that now to really continue that momentum to help our farmers?
We do need to focus on that. During this pandemic, we found out that a national food system probably is not the best thing to have. Mm-hmm. When you have your major meat suppliers out of the Midwest close all of a sudden because their workers became sick. That disrupted the food system in the Northeast. We are going to see, I think, a reset of maybe a more regional food system, and we're going to work on that at the Agency of Agriculture with our partners. We did see some pluses out of this. We did see more farm stands pop up. Mm-hmm. We did see more people turning to CSAs, buying their fruits and vegetables and meat and milk through a community-supported agriculture. We did see more people going to farmers markets, even though they were disrupted with maybe fewer markets. It wasn't a social event, but we did see people lining up to get their food that way. They thought it was a safer way to do it outside. There was disruption in our farmers markets. Not all of them, you know, were the same as they were. But I think there's been a reset. I think we're going back to the basics again. People really want to know where their food is coming from. They want to support their neighbors. And I think we just got to build upon that. We've got to give them our farmers and our producers, the infrastructure, the food distribution, those types of things to support them. Meat was another area that we need to work on a lot more. During the, you know, late winter, early spring, there's not a lot of busyness at some of our meat processing plants. They have not stopped since last March. Yeah. They have been going out straight. And so that's one of those areas we've got to work on, supporting our slaughterhouses, getting more workers, getting better infrastructure in there, because they can get a better output to supply local meat to our region.
To your point on the farmers markets, I went to the Montpelier Farmers Market the Saturday before Thanksgiving, and 45 minutes into the market, after it had opened, there was a line, socially distanced, all the way down State Street of people patiently waiting to get in. Just before Christmas, I went to the Burlington Farmers Market, 11 degrees, and you would have thought it was the middle of summer by the number of people who showed up to support the farmers. Anson, farms are always quick to come up in the conversation about the health of Lake Champlain. They're a major contributor of phosphorus pollution to the lake, but this year, your agency launched a pay-for-performance system to help address that. So can you talk us through how that works?
Yes, thanks for that question. This is a significant development in our challenge to help with our clean water. USDA, through NRCS, has recognized this program with us. What we're going to do is we're going to set up a program where we're going to give incentives for farmers. So we've got a number of regulations that farmers have to follow called the Required Agriculture Practices. Those are going to continue. If you get sideways on those, then there are penalties. But there's also an element of this. If we can reward the people that are doing great things, improving soil health, improving the land, We can now pay for that. So we're going to launch, and it's going to take off in January. We're going to sign up farmers. It's a voluntary program. If farmers want to sign up, they can join this pay-for-performance program. And then at the end of the day, if they meet standards within this program, they're going to be rewarded with dollars. We're going to give them money to do that. So we think if we get more people signed up into this program, it will be another revenue stream also for our dairy farmers and our vegetable farmers, but also it will improve water quality. So USDA liked what we put together. They've given us some dollars to do this program over the next few years. We also will have a program part of this where we'll even pay farmers to sign up for it, because sometimes farmers may be reluctant to sign up for something, and at the end of the day, they don't know if they're going to get the, you know, at the prize at the end of the program. Mm-hmm. This also, through the application process, will also give farmers some money to be part of the program. So we're pretty excited about this. The Vermont Land Trust also has another program that's looking at pay for performance. We've gotten together with the Vermont Land Trust. They see the value in that with their membership. So those two programs, I think, are going to have long-term benefits in improving water quality in a different strategy. We're going to continue to do our other program as well. This is just another companion with it that should help improve our water quality and hopefully improve the land and the water, and also maybe give our farmers another revenue stream.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Brian calling from Eden. Brian, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint. Go right ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm getting a kick out of hearing Anson's voice on DEV again. And this might not help the show along. It's not really a question, but I just want to thank people like Anson, not just, you know, I remember him from his first 2 weeks on DEV.
Oh, my.
Back in the day. He's just such an honest, straightforward, wonderful person given to public service, and I know he's going to blush and he hates his stuff, but I'm telling you, I still appreciate, like, and liberal Republicans, I guess he'd be labeled that way, but that's stupid, but that's his Vermont Republicans, going way back, and I just so appreciate the public service, the people left, right, and center who know what they're doing.
Well, thank you, Brian. You know, that's a great comment and great feedback that you got there, Anson, on your role with the Ag Department. So blush away. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I am blushing. Good thing it's radio because you can't see me. But right. Thank you, Brian. You're too kind. Of course, I learned a lot on the knee of WDEV. So, you know, I take our work seriously, and I think about our farmers every single day, and I think about, you know, the hard work they're doing. Mm-hmm. And Vermonters are rallying now. Vermonters are rallying, and they're doing what they can to support them, and that's what needs to happen. You know, they're not all good days. They're long days. They're not complaining. They're not whining. They're out there in the stuff, and they're feeding us. Keep in mind, farmers are feeding us. But I do see this as our opportunity. I really do see this as an opportunity. I've had conversations with the governor. The governor really wants to focus on a deep dive in agriculture in 2021, which is right around the corner. You're going to see more of that. He's discovered through this pandemic some of the gaps that are out there with what's happening. You know, the focus has always been on right now, you know, making sure everyone's safe and healthy and so forth. But I think 2021, we're going to see really focus on the economic recovery of Vermont, which has to happen. But I think there's an opportunity. We have to seize it right now with agriculture in this pandemic. And I think the opportunity is right. We're going to do a deep dive in that in coming 2020 and one about agriculture.
As a city kid, I have to say that you don't really realize what goes on a farm. And there are programs like the Breakfast on the Farm program that the Ag Department has that gets you out to somebody's dairy and to really see all that goes into that operation. And it really is eye-opening. It gives you a new perspective of why you do reach for that Monument Farms milk, or, you know, the local burger or the cheese that somebody's making, or butter. It really does give you a perspective. And those programs that the Ag Department does sponsor really are effective.
Yeah, you look at those programs, and that's one of the things we've kind of had to put on pause is those big, large gatherings. But, mm-hmm. you know, the Breakfast on the Farm event over the years is just eye-opening. Number one, you get a free breakfast, so that doesn't happen very often.
It's delicious.
So that's A, number one. It's beautiful morning. You arrive early. And then you get to see, you know, every farm is different, and that's the challenge in Vermont. You know, one size doesn't fit all. So you go, you maybe go to a big dairy, maybe you go to a small dairy, maybe you go to an organic dairy, maybe you go to a conventional dairy. They're all different. They're all different structures. They're all different family structures, and practices. So it's a challenge, but that's what we need in Vermont. We need diversity. We need big, small, little, you know, value added, all those kind of things. And we try to focus at the agency. We try to focus on giving people options and choices and giving them, you know, and support them in what avenue they want to go down to and what path they want to take. So that's kind of where we're at. But we hope for one day Breakfast on the Farm will come back. We did have a great virtual one. You'd be surprised how much great virtual stuff is happening. You don't get that experience. You don't get the smell. Of course, you don't get the free breakfast.
That's right.
But there are those great events that are going on, Rick.
Anson, what's exciting about next year for the Agency of Agriculture?
I think we're going to go back to the basics. I'm excited about, you know, once we get through this, and I think, you know, there is hope. We've got some more challenges. But people are doing incredible things out there. We work for the Department of Tourism and Marketing on a Buy Vermont Made. You go to that website and you see what people are doing now and what they're making with their hands and their and their food and whatever. I do see an opportunity. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There are challenges that we have to do. But I do see a sort of a reset. We need to work on distribution. We need to work on processing. We need to work on infrastructure. But Vermonters always are focused on quality, and that's what's going to have to set us apart from the rest of the country. We're not going to be big. We're not going to be massive, but if we focus on quality and craftsmanship and being able to get it to these markets, I think we have a bright future in agriculture, and we have a wonderful, you know, we just have a wonderful work ethic. We just got to get through these next few months.
Now, I know you're a birder. You're on the For the Birds program. And so I'm just going to, as we're wrapping up here, have you been able to spot one of these snowy owls that we've had here in Vermont?
Unbelievable. I have not. I've seen the one on Shelburne Road is the one that's people are really watching near the Rice Lumber. Mm-hmm. And then there's another one at the Morrisville Stowe Airport, which is another one. Those are the two that I have not been able to see them in person. But our state veterinarian, Dr. Haas, she has a wonderful camera. She's got this giant camera, so you can be well. She got the most beautiful pictures of the snowy owl one weekend in Shelburne. And it's just, they are the most magical things in the world. And if people get a chance, birding is one of those activities. You can get outside and enjoy this time of year. Feed those birds. I'm looking at mine right now. I've got a white-breasted nuthatch at mine right now. So there you go.
Beautiful. Anson Tebbets, thank you so much. It was really wonderful speaking with you. That's Anson Tebbets, Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. We're going to take a break for CBS News. When we come back, it's time. We're going to take the time to look at Vermont's bedrock with State Geologist John Kim. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Everything about Vermont fascinates me, so be prepared to be introduced to a wide range of subjects each day on this program. Now we're going to spend the next hour learning about Vermont's geology. The story of Vermont's formation is quite interesting, but learning how the makeup of what's beneath us can be of vital importance to solving modern-day problems is also worth knowing. Here to take us on that journey through the state's bedrock is State Geologist John Kim. John, thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
And listeners, don't hold back. If you've got a question about Vermont's geology, here is your chance to ask it. Our numbers are 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. John, how far back can we trace the geology of what is now Vermont?
Well, the oldest rocks known in Vermont are 1,400 million years old, and the youngest rocks that is, not sediments, are about 50 million years old.
Wow.
So the rocks span a large age range, and then if we want to consider modern deposits, it goes right up to the present.
Mm. What major occurrences have taken place in that formation of our bedrock?
Well, one of the ways to think about the geology of Vermont and the Northeast is that if you just imagine a line of longitude, essentially going from about Montreal down to Burlington, down to Albany, New York, and imagine that everything to the east has been added to this old continent called Laurentius since about 450 million years ago. And so there's just repeated episodes of what we call orogeny or mountain building, and I've just pasted on all these long north-south pieces going all the way to the Atlantic off of Boston.
Wow. So, but west of that is a little bit more stable. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, I'm using that for an example. So when I use that line of longitude, basically when you think of, say, the Champlain Valley, or if you go up to Montreal to see Cirque du Soleil or something, or go around to east of Albany, you see there's just lots of limestone. And the limestone was part of an ancient ocean called Iapetus, which started to open up about 570 million years ago. And so one of the things to think about is that the Iapetus Ocean is an ocean basically three times removed from the Atlantic. So we had oceans opening and closing over geologic time. And so to use the Burlington, Montreal, including up to Quebec City and heading down the western side of New England as a reference, that was in present coordinates the ancient shoreline of Vermont, which was a continent called Laurentia, and it was shallow, probably pretty warm water, and believe it or not, we were about 20 degrees south of the equator at that time. Although you look at the current globe, you think of it in terms of, well, everything's been just sitting there forever.
Right.
Well, if we use forever, it hasn't. Continents have been drifting, crashing into one another, forming mountain ranges, forming oceans, and it's all going on, and the state of modern geology has actually been able to unravel that.
We kind of think of geology and rock formations and bedrock as being like the most solid things you can think about here on this earth, immovable. And you make it sound as if it's just kind of some kind of soupy molten lava that just has been kind of moving around and, over these thousands of millions of years. So how do these formations, kind of move in that way? And are they moving under us right now?
Well, the whole theory, which is actually has enormous amount of documentation of plate tectonics, is that the continents have been moving around on the surface of the Earth, essentially on the upper part of the mantle, for millions or even billions of years. And so the basic tenets of plate tectonics is that you form oceans at a mid-ocean ridge, and that they spread. The Atlantic Ocean is spreading at about probably 2 inches per year, and then that's where two plates are moving apart. Where plates come together, you end up having one plate going underneath any other, and often forming what we call island arcs, where you have a tremendous amount of volcanism, where one plate is going underneath the other, is melting, being consumed, and the magmas from this are actually rising into the crust above what we call subduction zones or trenches, and forming these island complexes. such as, think about Indonesia and various places out there. New Zealand is an island arc. And there are island arcs throughout the landscape on all the continents. We actually have an island complex that we would call the Bronson Hill Belt, which is on the easternmost side of Vermont, just west of the Connecticut River, and goes into New Hampshire. So the geology, it's a long, long, slow tape recorder. And as the continents are opening up, like I said, we're talking probably at a couple inches a year the oceans are opening up. But then multiply that by 100 years, then 1,000 years. And then as continents, or actually as one plate goes underneath the other, an oceanic plate, that can happen at, say, 10 centimeters per year, or say 4 inches per year. So you don't want to think about it as looking at that over your lifetime, but then run out into thousands of years and then millions, and end up with large distances and spectacular things happening, like mountain building events, say like in the Himalayas or the Rockies or the Andes or wherever you want to look.
So let's talk about Vermont. In our 9,600 square miles of this state, is there much geological diversity?
Yeah, and so I think I want to start, Rick, and just making a point. So if we look at basically the formal definition of geology, it's the study of the Earth. And then, so it's not just rocks, but obviously the rocks are the basement of it. And we geologists sometimes talk that it's rocks, it's dirt, and it's water, and it's over time. So anyway, if we looked at the state of Vermont, I wish I could be waving my hands in front of a map or something. But there are, such as the new 2011 bedrock map that was a joint effort between the U.S. Geological Survey, the Vermont Geological Survey, UVM, and a bunch of other partners. But anyway, so Vermont is comprised by basically six different bedrock belts, which are rocks of similar age and character that were assembled during these various, what I'm calling, mountain building events, where essentially one plate collides with the other and makes mountains. So if you look to the west side, think about the Champlain Valley. So if you could, you could drive all the way from St. Albans down to Rutland in the Champlain Valley, then keep going south along Route 7, through what they call the Vermont Valley geographically, but it's the exact same rocks all the way down to the Massachusetts border. And then as you go to the east, then there's a big, long north-south belt of Green Mountain rocks, Green Mountain Belt. And these rocks are some of the oldest in Vermont. And as you move to the east, right about at the longitude of Montpelier, going down the eastern side of the state, we make a break to what's called the Connecticut Valley Belt. And these are rocks that are considerably younger. And we can actually see the expression in the landscape as a major change in erodibility moving to the east. The next time you're going by exit 8 in Montpelier, going either side on 89, take a look. And that boundary is, at 70 miles an hour, you'll see on the left or west, you'll see green rocks. On the right or east, you'll see black rocks. And at this area, that is a major fault that's about 380 million years old.
Wow.
And so, but okay, and I just want to say beforehand, when I say faults, many people start to get worried.
Right.
This is something that's
my mind went there. Yep.
So these are ancient, ancient faults. They have not been active in millions and millions of years.
Well,
and the last, just the
keep
last
going,
thing
yeah.
is that as we go across the Connecticut Valley Belt, which is essentially where a lot of the you know, agriculture is on the east side of the state, we finally get to about the Connecticut River, and these are the rocks that were one of these island complexes called the Bronson Hill Belt, and that was the sliver of islands that collided with then the North American margin about 450 or 460 million years ago. So we've got six major bedrock belts and all of different character and ages. And I need to not leave out in the southwest part of the state what we call the Taconic Olathons or the Taconics. Mm. That is the slate belt.
Mm-hmm.
So the Taconic Mountains are essentially slate and limestones, and they are sitting on top of the Champlain Valley rocks along a major fault.
John, I want you to stay the whole hour, but if for some reason you hang up the phone right now, just that, what you told us about what we can observe driving on 89 at exit 8 was well worth the price of admission so far. That is fascinating to know that you can see that line, the fault line right there. John, why is the study of all this of any importance?
Well, I think one of the things that many people think is that geology is cool,
yeah,
but it's just cool in itself, and it's worth knowing, but it's not as applicable as perhaps other sciences. And I want to point out that essentially all the details of the geology, much of which I've been relating, all the different pieces are important for solving environmental problems in Vermont, such as groundwater contamination in different places with different chemicals, natural or anthropogenic. They're involved with understanding rock slides and landslides. And so the geology, when you say the geology, you think it's one thing, but it's actually different pieces. And so just like, and here's just kind of an example that maybe people are used to, is that if you think about an engineering, civil engineering for buildings and bridges, there are chemical engineers for chemical formation. There are electrical engineers for electricity and for software and chips and circuits. Geologists, there are many different types as well. And there's no way for any one particular type or discipline of geology to know everything that's necessary to solve an environmental problem. And so we often have teams of geologists, including the Vermont Geological Survey, Middlebury College, University of Vermont, the State University of New York at Plattsburgh, the University of Massachusetts, and Bennington College, working together as different experts trying to put all the pieces together. And one way to think about it, so I think I'll make the groundwater contamination piece as simple as I can.
Okay.
So once you have a contaminant of some sort, whether it's PFOA in Bennington or some of the firefighting foams in Rutland, and it's on the ground surface, but then where does it go? And then how do you know? And so at that point, what we do is we need to be able to become essentially plumbers. We need to understand where it's going, where it might go, where it came from. And in order to do that, it's not that we just sit at our desk with computers and use fancy software to figure out the whole story. We need to be out there with doing our mapping of the bedrock formations, our mapping of the surficial or glacial deposits. We need to involve geochemists that can understand the chemistry of the groundwater and where the groundwater has been moving, how old it is, and how we know that. It involves dating the ages of the groundwater, it determining whether there are heavier or lighter isotopes in the groundwater. And so it's all important thing. We want to know as best we can what the underground plumbing is like in a contaminant area so we can advise on where the groundwater contaminants are going, where they've been, where they might go in the future. And we use everything we possibly can to understand that. And that can include drone surveys. Down in the Clarendon Airport area where there's been a contamination problem. If you know any airport, it's a beautifully flat place for planes to take off and land.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the land has been completely reshaped, in order to make an airport, but there's not a lot of places to look at what's underneath. We need a three-dimensional model of what's underneath the airport. So we'll look everywhere we can, and there's a beautiful gorge south of the airport where there's continuous bedrock exposed for nearly a mile. And we can look at those areas, looking at with our hands and knees, with compasses, taking 35-millimeter photographs, taking drone photographic surveys, and put all this information together and then project it as best we can underneath the airport. And the last thing I wanted to point out, because I'm getting, you may think I'm getting carried away, I'm just getting excited.
I know.
Is that
it's great stuff.
With wells, where we don't have any view of the bedrock or deposits beneath our feet, we have wells. And my colleague at State University near Plattsburgh is a geophysicist and hydrogeologist, and we can lower tools that will look at the inside of a well down as far as 1,500 feet. And we can look at the temperature in the water, the salinity of the water, where all the cracks are that might be bringing water contaminants into the well. We have videos of the wells. And it's funny to get a bunch of geologists together to watch a borehole video. You might not think it's very exciting, but we do. I'll show you sometime.
All right. It sounds
so putting all that together. That together is what we want to do. Every branch of geology that we can basically recruit to understand in three dimension what's going on with groundwater contaminants beneath a contaminated area. That's kind of a grand example for the groundwater contamination.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really fascinating stuff. When you describe really a 3D map, I would think you'd have to drill, bazillion holes in the earth and, to find out exactly what's beneath us. But you don't absolutely have to do that kind of thing to know exact or a pretty good estimation of what's beneath a certain area.
Well, what we do is we're going to take whatever data we can add. So, for example, if wells are the only thing, in terms of on the airport property, pretty much, that's most of what we have. There are a few outcrops on airport property. But areas where we have bedrock outcroppings, we can take our measurements and look at how the rock has been folded and faulted. And that goes right into our cerebral data sets.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to actually think about then how does that, what we can see, make a 3D model, but then we'll supplement it with using our geophysical tools and our drone surveys. And then, and just a point about the chemistry, because I know many listeners may not have favorable experiences of chemistry in high school and in college.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do with the chemistry is that for a particular contaminant, we want to do contact tracing, and that, using a COVID type analogy, but every well where we can sample the groundwater, if we have contaminants, we're going to measure about 40 other different things because we want to know where that water was and how it moved. And so within the 3D framework. So there are two major parts. One is building the physical 3D framework. And then the second is using those contact tracers of the contaminant and other chemical parameters to figure out how the plumbing worked in the network. Long explanation.
All right. I was going to go to a call. I think, do we have Bill? No, we lost that call. So we've driven these kind of artificial state lines and country borders, around Vermont. But is the makeup of Vermont similar to any of our near neighbors?
So around the edges of the state, the answer is absolutely yes. So, for example, like I said, the Champlain Valley, so you're on Burlington, the limestones and shales around Burlington, they project northward right up to the Vermont-Quebec border, and then you can follow those for miles and miles in Quebec. For example, that, if we look at, remember I talked about driving along I-89 near Montpelier,
mm-hmm.
That particular fault zone or line between the older and younger rock types, we can actaspertrace that all the way up to the Gaspé in southern Quebec.
Wow.
And then also that same line in general makes its way all the way down to Long Island Sound. So north and south, the formations are similar and extend. And on the west side and the east side, there are definitely basically similarities in the rock formations and glacial deposits on the land with adjacent states. There are some things that don't make it north into Quebec, some formations, and some that don't make it all down into, say, Massachusetts. But, yeah, we have an overall framework for the New England part of the Appalachian Mountain Chain.
How about elsewhere on Earth? I had heard that we shared similar bedrock makeup to the area, some areas in the British Isles.
Yes, that's definitely true. So in terms of the past, I'd say it's the past 2.5 decades, huge progress has been made on how different parts of the world actually were once together in this puzzle matrix of continental pieces. And so if we were to start with, for example, there are parts of Vermont, say parts in the Champlain Valley equivalents that may have correlatives in South America, Argentina. There are parts of New England and Vermont that have correlatives in Quebec, going all the way to Newfoundland. There are parts that are correlative with rocks and the mountain building events in Scotland and Wales and in England. So, yeah, so if you know that this is a long, long movie where you're moving continents around, they're crashing into one another and forming new bodies, we've got characteristics that are similar with our neighbors to the north and south, to the east and west, and then long-distance correlations, like I said, possibly with South America and the United Kingdom, et cetera, Norway, et cetera.
Ah, fascinating stuff. We're going to take a few moments for the CBS News update, and then we're going to return with Vermont State Geologist John Kim. If you'd like to join the conversation, our numbers are 244-1777. You can also reach us at 877-291-8255, and our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. That ground you're standing on right now or driving on top of was formed millions of years ago. It's cool knowing the history of how Vermont geological makeup can be, but there's also value in knowing what sits beneath us for very practical and contemporary reasons. Here to explain all of that is State Geologist John Kim. If you'd like to ask John a question, we're having a little bit of problems with the phones. You might have to leave your question with our director, Danny, but our numbers are 244-1777-877-291-8255. Might be easier to email right now, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And John Kim, we did get a call, and Bill in Plainfield wanted to know a couple things. He wanted to know about the Isle Lamotte limestone and then the history of Mount Escutney. So two different, very different parts of the state, but let's start with Isle Lamotte.
Okay, basically, Isle Lamotte, obviously one of the Champlain Islands, sits in what we call the Champlain Valley Belt, which is all these limestones and shales. And Isle Lamotte, one of the spectacular things about Isle Lamotte, and if you've ever been to the Goodsell Nature Preserve or the guided walk that takes you through these corals,
yep.
They're stromatoporite corals, really long name, that they're basically bulbous, earliest form of corals, and I think we're talking maybe about 470 million years old, but this is some of the first corals in existence in geologic history. And if you go up to the nature walk up there, you can walk along these, I call them pavement outcrops because you're walking all of them on your feet.
Right.
And you can actually see these big tops of these bulbs of these ancient corals. And if you were to, if you've ever been scuba diving or skin diving in the Keys, Florida Keys, you can imagine what it would be like to actually just be kind of swimming amongst these. So, yeah, that's a great spot, and they've done an amazing job with annotated signs for that. And for Monascutney in southern Vermont, it's really interesting. The Monascutney is, you're looking at the, well, basically you're looking at the base of an ancient volcano. The volcano is about 120 million years ago, 123 million to be exact from the radioactive dating. And so you're looking down below the surface at what was, I mean, what's at the surface now is the magma chamber that was way, way below, a mile or so below the volcano. And so the Mount Ascutney igneous rocks are part of a series of these igneous rocks of about 100 to 120 million years old, that include Mount Ascutney, Little Ascutney, and then if any of you that have seen the Cuttingsville rocks down near Rutland in the hills, mm-hmm. or the dark-colored lamprophere, which means dark crystal dikes that you see in the limestones of the Champlain Valley. You can see them at Charlotte Beach. You can see them in many other places. This is part of this magmatic event about 100 to 120 million years ago. That's what I got, Bill.
All right. Great questions from Bill in Plainfield. John, you've mentioned, you know, it's what we know about what's beneath us can really help us with questions today, challenges today. Give us another example of how you use geology in a contemporary sense.
Yeah, so... And I should point out that so we're a small division in the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, and we basically consider our other divisions in D.C. essentially to be clients, whether it be the Waste Management Prevention Division, the Water Investment Division, the Watershed Management Division. And so there are various problems that come up. And right now, we're working on a project up at Lake Carmine, which is right up near the Quebec border.
Mm-hmm.
And in this lake, over decades, phosphorus has been involved in feeding blue green algae blooms. And so the current thinking is that this is all coming in from the hills in surface water, whether it brooks or streams. We're taking a first look at, is it possible that some of this phosphorus, at least, is coming in from groundwater? And so we've designed a project with our partners, and that includes Middlebury College and State University of New York at Plattsburgh and UVM. And we're basically making, like, the stage one, which is a three-dimensional model of the geology of the Lake Carmine watershed. And then we're going to look at all the different tracers that I talked about, so the contact tracing, in the different surface water and groundwater samples from wells. We're going to actually measure and analyze the same type of geochemical parameters. In addition to phosphorus, we'll do nitrate. We're going to do herbicides because they're possibly related to farming activities. And we'll do everything else that will tell us whether also what rock formations the groundwater flow through on its way to the lake. So this is another project where we look at things, we build a three-dimensional framework, and then we want to see exactly how the plumbing, the hydrologic plumbing, works in this model, and to see whether it's possible that phosphorus in some capacity is coming from groundwater, whether it be anthropogenic sources feeding the groundwater or possibly natural.
You mentioned the Vermont Geological Survey, and I've heard that many times. I always think of you guys out with clipboards asking rocks questions. It always confuses me exactly what the Vermont Geological Survey is. So how does that fit into being the state geologist and being in that area of state government that you're in?
Well, what the Vermont Geological Survey does is we're making geologic surveys of the Vermont landscape, mm-hmm. and we're providing aid and advice to any agency, division, or Vermonter that wants it. And so what we do is we make, for example, bedrock geologic maps. We make surficial or glacial material geologic maps ourselves or with contractors. We work with other partners where we'll do the groundwater chemistry in detail. We do a lot of that. We also work with our Middlebury College partner on that. We'll look in detail at, for example, the cracks. The cracks are fractures in the rocks that are the ones that are carrying the groundwater and contaminants. We'll work with our University of Vermont structure geology partners to put that part together so we have an idea of the plumbing and the pathways. So we make geologic maps. We do the geochemistry. We also, for example, have partners that we work with on understanding landslides and rock slides, such as those that have occurred at Smuggler's Notch. So, I mean, we're a small group, basically of three, but we actually have a network of really, really important academic partners and students that do our work. I mean, all of it is in the name of solving environmental problems for, what I said in quotation marks, our clients, whether they be at the Department of Environmental Conservation. We also have projects with the Agency of Agriculture, also with the Vermont Department of Health. So, kind of a long answer, but yeah, we're kind of the hub for doing mapping and integrating with partners to help us solve the problems.
John, you've mentioned a couple times something that I think is absolutely wonderful. About 10 years ago, your department updated the Vermont Bedrock Geological Map. So explain to people what it shows.
Well, first of all, I want to talk to you about it was actually a colossal effort to do this map. So the previous map was published in 1961. And basically almost 50 years later, the new 2011 map came out. And this was a 30-year collaboration between the U.S. Geological Survey, who handled the mapping in the southern half of Vermont, and the University of Vermont and Vermont Geological Survey and many other partners that handled the northern half. And the U.S. Geological Survey had put it together in geographic information software format. And they published it, but it was a total joint effort over about 30 years and more than 100 geologists. And one thing to think about here is that I think many folks that maybe not have a geology background think that this is all mainly a computer mapping exercise. And the mapping that was done is actually geologists in sturdy hiking boots with compasses and GPS units, and this actually started before even GPS units were used or any good. And so this map was an unbelievable update to the 1961 map, because one of the things most people don't think about, you think about plate tectonics, which is the continents move around, crash into each other, make mountain belts, and open oceans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, this map basically update the in detail the 61 map, but shows an enormous amount of new detail, lots and lots of the ancient faults. It allows you to look in much greater detail at what the bedrock world looks like in three dimensions. And I should point out that although it's beautiful to have on your wall, it's 9 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
I told my wife that we have to actually put it on the chimney outside to make it fit in our house.
I had to bend mine on the ceiling to make it fit.
Yeah, but it was a tremendous effort. And one of the things is, because it's available online and in GIS, Geographic Information Software format, mm-hmm. There are people all over Vermont and every state agency that does any sort of an environmental study that uses this as a background for whether it be a groundwater quantity issue or a groundwater quality or contamination issue. We use it, for example, in understanding what rock types and formations have a propensity to slide and form rock falls and things like that. That's a summary of this map, and if you should go to our website, you can look at it online and see it in different parts. And if you want to buy one, you're all obviously welcome to. But I think this is an amazing effort in great detail, and in addition to being quote cool, it's framework geology for the modern environmental problem.
Yeah. So you mentioned a lot of people getting involved with that. I think some are volunteers. Are there like citizen science type projects in the geology realm that people can get involved with?
From time to time, we have somebody that would offer to help with making maps or assist in a geologic project. Most of the mappers that contributed to the bedrock geologic map in particular were government geologists, they were academic geologists, and they were students of working either with the USGS, they were master's and PhD students, and, bachelor's, master's, and PhD students with the northern half, that was, the Vermont Geological Survey and UVM portion. Mm-hmm. But we involve, people that are interested whenever we can. We also tend to have a fair amount of student interns that do. We have they're paid and they do a professional quality work to essentially benefit the environmental problems we're trying to solve.
We think of when we think of the minerals that we have here, we think of our three state rocks. We've got the marble, we've got the slate, we've got the granite. But I know some of the others, for instance, like talc was mined here, copper. Are there great deposits of other minerals here in Vermont?
If you're talking about, the slate industry is still going.
Yep.
The marble industry is still going, and the granite industry is still going. A lot of other particular smaller scale minerals, mining is, there's not a lot of that going on. You mentioned talc, and talc in the general geologic, terms is a magnesium rich mineral that's associated with the big pieces of what we call ultramafic rock. And right now most people are going, oh no, he's using that term, ultramafic. But these are pieces, they call it ultramafic, they're basic, and the punchline is the ultramafic rocks are pieces of the mantle of the earth that are now sitting up on our mountain sides. And that's because of these mountain building events. And the talc that we find, at least most of it, is associated with these type of occurrences, associated with pieces torn off from the mantle and are now sitting up in the mountainous landscape along the faults.
We only have a few minutes left, but I do want to ask you about great places in the state where people can go and see evidence of our geological past.
Well, you know what? I think that's a great question to ask, because one of the things is, I think that if you say that Vermont's geology is complex, you get people to think, oh no, it's not knowable. But my advice is to go to your favorite state park, go to your favorite town park, and actually just start to understand the geology around you before jumping to try and understand the geology of the whole state. Some great places that are very popular to go are, if you wanted to see the whole west half of the state and what's going on there, is Mount Philo State Park or, Snake Mound, because you get a 180-degree panoramic view on top.
Yeah.
The top of Mount Mansfield gives you a view basically over into the Adirondacks on the west side and into New Hampshire on the east side. And each one of these state parks, particularly those that have geology or natural history write-ups, are great places to start to look at and just get a handle for yourself on the geology near you. And so that's what I recommend. I mean, okay, I'm somebody that loves all the state parks, mm-hmm. but I suggest you start maybe one near you.
You got it. And what about Willoughby? I mean, we have this Glacier Lake. What does that mean? And then we have the two, I think, Mount Hoar and Mount Pisgah on either side. Pretty phenomenal piece of property there.
Yeah, it is. And Lake Willoughby basically sits between two granite bodies.
Mm.
And the lake is actually, if you've been down to the south end of the lake, you can look up at Mount Pisgah. And you can actually see, so as you go from the south end of the lake towards the town of Westmore, mm-hmm. just looking to the north, you can see where to the north you're looking at all granite. And then as you're down near in the parking lot, the south end looking up, you can see all gray schist. But the gray schist is riddled with pipes and pipes of granite going each direction. And that's actually showing that, I mean, essentially, Mount Pisgah is right at the boundary between the Willoughby granite body and the neighboring or the adjacent Waits River Formation bedrock. And there's the landscape around Lake Willoughby, you know, was a mature landscape, you know, even before the glaciers came. But then the glaciers actually excavated the valley a bit deeper and made it a little bit wider. So anyway, when you're looking at Mount Pisgah and then you're on one side looking over at Mount Hoar, you're actually looking at that there's two different granite bodies and the contact with the surrounding schist between them. So highly recommend it.
It is great. John Kim is the state geologist and the leading scientist with the Vermont Geological Survey. John, thank you for this fascinating trip around the state this morning.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.